private. NASA has nothing to do with it. NASA paid them to launch their cargo vehicles up. So in the early days when they were doing that and they were still trying to save the booster, I would have two websites, you know, playing. I'd have SpaceX and then I'd also be playing NASA. NASA would show the launch. They would get the Dragon spacecraft into orbit, go into the International Space Station. And that would be it. You want to see the landing for by NASA because that's not, you know, that's all experimental for SpaceX. That's on their dime. So you go to the other computer and you look at your SpaceX.com webcast, and sure enough, you'd see the landing either going back to land or going back to your autonomous ship out at sea. This WS2N.
The returning of the booster, I guess the first few were done over water or to the barge because they hadn't yet proven the concept. But later on, they started launching right back to Cape Canaveral, I guess, or close to launch pad 39A, I'm guessing. So essentially all of the return to launch over land, essentially all of them were successful, Paul. Only the ones that failed are the early ones on the barge. Go ahead.
Yeah, they haven't had a failure on land yet. But yeah, the early ones are fun to watch, you know. and they make improvements next time out. You know, they get better and better every time. But these things would blow up on the deck. They missed the boat all together, hit the water. You know, amazing. But then he got better and better. And they still do that. They still land on the barge, depending on the mission. If you have a very heavy satellite, it takes a lot of energy to do that. They won't have that extra 30% of fuel that they need to get back to land. So they still land on the autonomous ships. But now with the Block 5, they've increased their thrust. And they both, you know, they're able to put the same payload into orbit, and now they're able to make it back to land. But now they could also launch a heavier payload, and again, they won't make it back to land. So they'll put it out to sea. There were a few missions in the last 2 years where they didn't need the Block 4 anymore. They would launch it, and they'd bring it back, it would land on a ship, or back at land. And then the next mission, they were only good for two launches. The next mission, they would just push the satellite into space and just let it go into the sea and not recover it. There were maybe three or four of them in the last couple of years. So, but they were intended. They became a throwaway. Back to you there.
Okay, what do we have to look forward to now as to the next launch? When and what will it be, Paul? And will we be able to watch it like we just watched this one? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm not sure the next space launch, SpaceX launch. I think it's going to be a month or so for that next launch. But next one I'm interested in is a NASA test. They're going to be testing an Orion spacecraft in April, and they want to do an ascent abort test. So they're taking a Orion spacecraft, similar to what you're going to put people in a couple of years from now, and they're going to put it on top of a Peacekeeper missile. Now, the diameter of this Orion spacecraft is bigger than the Dragon, it's bigger than the Boeing Starliner. It's a big spacecraft that's going to carry four people. It's bigger than, I think it's a little over 17 feet in diameter. The Peacekeeper rocket is only like 12 feet in diameter, or less, I think, maybe less than that. So they're making up a complete adapter. So it's going to look like a very short rocket taking off from Cape Canaveral. And the idea is to test the abort system. You know, it's going to launch. It's going to go like 5 miles high. And then the
Agency.
Well, the LAS system, the launch abort system, is going to separate the Orion spacecraft from this Peacekeeper missile. So it's duplicating a real launch on top of the SLS rocket that they're building. So in other words, what would happen if you get 4 or 5 miles high and the rocket blows up or something, will the spacecraft be able to get away? And they're going to have this launch abort system.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And then it has a stabilizing rocket near the top. It, you know, it's another solid booster type of rocket, but it's got these valves that open independently for the exhaust. So these valves will be controlling the attitude of the spacecraft so that the crew inside is going to be doing tumble sorts as they get separated by the big heavy launch abort system. And then there's another set of rockets called the jettison rockets. They're going to pull the top part of the spacecraft away, exposing the Orion spacecraft all by itself, and allowing the parachutes to be able to open. Once that shield is gone, then the parachutes will be able to open. There's a series of 11 parachutes that will drop the crew. Well, there's not going to be a crew in there, but simulated crew back into the ocean in the Atlantic. By the way, this is going to take place in California. So I thought that was pretty cool. They're going to use a different launch complex. Launch complex 46, so for this type of test. When they actually do launch people from, when NASA launches people on the SLS space launch system and the Orion spacecraft, it'll be Launch Complex 39B, you know. SpaceX has taken over the other big launch complex called 39A. You know, they were twins, so SpaceX has that one. They also have another one in California called Launch Complex 40. And they actually launch rockets from both locations, the 39A and 40. So it's becoming a very busy place down in Florida, that's for sure. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
I have nothing to add to that one, Paul. So go on to your next item if you want to.
Okay. Opportunity, they're still looking to hear from Opportunity riding around on Mars. Have pictures of it. The Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, something called a high-rise camera on board that. And they look down and they can actually see solar cells of Opportunity sitting on the surface. But NASA keeps, well, not in the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. NASA has the JPL trying to contact Opportunity and seeing if it is able to recharge its batteries. So far, no good. Now I heard they have up until January to do it. So hopefully that will be a success, because that thing landed, what, 2004 in January, and it's still riding around after all these years. It landed with Spirit a couple of weeks apart. Spirit stopped working in 2009, 9 years ago. But this thing keeps going and going, like the Energizer Buddy. And meanwhile, Curiosity has its own problems as of a couple of days ago. Curiosity is the other Mars rover that's riding around on Mars that's nuclear powered, and we don't have to worry about solar panels, but we do have to worry about the memory on board. They have problems with the storage of memory. Can't store enough memory and then transmit it when a satellite is overhead. Just can't do it. Something with the flash memory, drop it. But NASA, in its wisdom, since days of early flights and early everything with NASA, they believe in redundancy. So there's a computer A on board and computer B. It landed with computer A. You realize computer A has a problem after a while, after I think, I don't know, a couple hundred days. So they switched over to computer B. In that time, they managed to figure out what was wrong with computer A. They picked that all up, and it's just sitting there as a backup. Now computer B has a completely different problem, a memory problem, where I can't store anything as flash memory. So now I gotta switch back to computer A and see what happens. And then again, they said if we could figure out what's wrong with B and fix that, they're gonna send it back to B and operate on B. So that's the story with the with Mars rover. Does anybody have any questions on that? Okay, very good. Let's get the tone. Down in South America, the Ariane 5 rocket has finished its 100th mission. The Ariane 5 rocket is European Space Agency version of the largest heavy lift rocket. 100 missions, you know, like 99% success rate or something. But they plan on launching only about 22 more missions. Eventually that will be retired in a couple of years. That will be succeeded by Ariane 6, which is under development. For now, Ariane 5, it's so reliable that NASA decided when they were building the James Webb Space Telescope, which was supposed to be launched, I think, a year or so ago, keeps getting delayed, or now it's delayed until 2021. They still plan on launching it on the Ariane 5 rocket. So it'll be one of the last flights, another year or so after that, bring Ariane 5 to a close. The last planned flight for Ariane is actually something called JUICE. JUICE is a Jupiter Icy Moon Explorer. So the European Space Agency actually going to send a mission to Jupiter, and plans on looking at a lot of the moons of Jupiter. But you know, that's the story with Ariane 5. Very successful over the years. It has a fuel that uses liquid hydrogen, just like we used to use for the space shuttle. Liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. And at one time, they planned on actually launching people from Ariane 5, but that was canceled many decades ago. But it's been a very successful rocket for the European Space Agency. They have three types of vehicles. Everybody likes to have three types of vehicles. You know, like to have a heavy lift vehicle, and you like to have medium and a low lift. And they have all three in European Space Agency, and they all launch from French Guyana, the northern part of South America. The three heavy lift, three vehicles they use are the Ariane 5 for the heavy lift vehicle, and then they have, for the light vehicle, they have Vega. Vega is built by Italy. It's pretty much a solid booster rocket. And they put smaller payloads into orbit. And then they have a medium lift vehicle, and it's the Soyuz. It's the Soyuz rocket. Not the Soyuz spacecraft, but the Soyuz rocket. Same one that Russia has been launching for many, many decades. But the European Space Agency over the last, I guess, 6 or 7 years has purchased the Soyuz rocket, and they work on it, and they change it around a lot, but that's what they use. They have a similar launch complex that Russia uses when they launch their Soyuz rockets, and a lot of times they bring Russians in to help them do the work to get that thing off the ground. Since the last night, it was a couple of nights ago, we talked about the HTV going up from Japan. One of the many cargo vehicles that go up to the International Space Station and supply them with food and science equipment, EVA equipment. Since 2 weeks ago, they have launched the HTV successfully from Japan, and it is now docked with the International Space Station. They attached it to the Harmony port, Earth-facing side, location and presently unloading all the science equipment, food, clothes, and what have you. Thousands and thousands of pounds, actually. I think they carry like 14,000 pounds, almost that much up. They have a pressurized section where they take everything out, and then they have an unpressurized section in that HCV spacecraft where they carry huge batteries. You know, each battery weighs like 400 pounds or something, and they'll reach in there and they'll grab it with the robotic arm. And it's quite a useful vehicle, and it's got some interesting science things that we talked about on it, including the small space elevator test that I'm interested in. They'll put the satellite out, which is going to have a satellite at one end of the cable, a satellite at the other end of the cable, and they're going to have this little car, this little elevated type of car moving from one end to the other end. I still haven't got many details on it, you know, what's powering it, how many bolts, how many amps it's going to take, you know, is it just battery powered, is it solar powered, they're going to do one test, 100 tests, I just don't know. And then just let it, you know, deorbit. Very small, little car that moves back and forth. It's about 6 inches long, you know. So that was the HTV. Successfully got up there. And that's it. WS2N. Any questions or comments? And there's an endless supply of stories, Dick, so I don't know. I should turn this thing over to Roy. I really should. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, WS2N.
Roy, I now remember the portion of the letter that I didn't quite agree with. Free space loss goes up as a square of frequency ratio, and free space loss goes up as the square of distance. However, range does not go up as a function of square of frequency. If I double the frequency, free space loss goes up 4-to-1 ratio, 6 dB. If I then decrease the range, I pick up that 6 dB back. I didn't square the range, I went linear. So range versus frequency is linear. And the way it was stated in the letter, he made it sound like range is a square law of frequency. It's only linear with frequency, range. AC2GS, K2RIW, I wonder if you saw that difference, Roy, go ahead.
Well, he didn't get into any of those details as far as where I'm just, I was the one who brought up the free space path loss and the relationship to the square of frequency. I didn't really go into range, I just went into the simpler aspects of it. And I mentioned also the Frisk transmission equation. I thought it would amuse him to look that thing up as well. So he really didn't have that many details, he was just asking questions about it.
I'm pretty sure I did read range versus frequency is square. I don't know if it was your reply or his original question, but I can't find it right now. I guess it's time to go to one of those other science issues, if that's what you would like to go to, Roy. Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Dick. I just want to mention once again a few little things. If anyone has any email questions, comments, topics. I got a few of them this week, and it's always a pleasure. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And once again, I want to point people to my webpage link, roy.ac2gs.com. I have a few things that are new that are posted. And if I actually get to any of the other stuff, I'll post that as well tonight. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, I think that many people know about the great teacher, Professor Walter Lewin from MIT. Well, thanks MIT, YouTube has a fine selection of Professor Lewin's excellent physics lectures available for all of you guys see without paying MIT a bit of tuition. Now, Professor Lewin has since retired from his post at MIT, but he hasn't retired from teaching. He's been uploading physics problems and their solutions from some room in his home for some time now. So if you like physics problems or the New York Times crossword puzzle isn't supplying the challenge that you require, I've posted a link to Professor Lewin's collection of physics problems. It's on the webpage, roy.ac2gs.com, so have fun with it. Let me drop. Okay, I've also already posted a link to a series of YouTubes on my site, roy.ac2gs.com. A couple of weeks ago, Tapper had a digital communications conference in association with the ARRL. Now, Tapper members are some of the best and brightest and some of the bleeding-edge technology in our hobby. They are into software-defined radio, they're into low-power digital signals, all kinds of things. And the fellow who recorded these discussions is still editing all this material. So it's not yet posted in its entirety. There will be more videos in the coming days, but I have found these conferences personally to be very informative. And so I hope some of you find some of these of interest. Again, it's linked on my page. And on the subject of Tapper, we're involved in something called pure signal adaptive predistortion, which is sort of in line with the earlier conversation that they say that they can bring down intermod distortion on the final amplification stage by 10 decibels. So they're rather smart guys and they're doing rather interesting things. Let me drop for a moment. Okay, I've also posted on my website a link to a series of rather beautiful pictures taken by Japan's Minerva 2 rovers from the surface of the asteroid Ryugu, an asteroid 174 million miles from Earth. The rovers were dispatched from Japan's Hayabusa 2 space probe, which arrived in orbit around the asteroid back in June. So if you haven't seen them yet, check things out. Minerva, by the way, is an acronym for Micro Nano Experimental Robot Vehicle for Asteroids, second generation. The Minerva 2 probes are true rovers capable of moving around the asteroid's surface, but instead of using wheels or rollers, they relocate themselves by hopping across the surface of the asteroid. If you're wondering why they were designed without conventional wheels or treads, the microgravity of the asteroid would be strong enough to keep the probes on their surface. Now, the probe wheels would drive them straight into outer space. Now, let me drop for a second. Now, just this week, other German-French robots just landed on the surface of the asteroid Ryugu to keep the two Japanese ones company. This really shouldn't be very surprising since this robot, the Mobile Asteroid Surface Scout, or Mascot, was deployed from the same Japanese Hayabusa 2 space probe and landed on the asteroid Ryugu on October 3rd. Now, Mascot had a very short operational lifespan and stopped functioning by October 4th, the very next day. Mascot's mission was successful. It was designed to be a short-lived one, and the lithium-ion battery was expected only to last about 16 hours, and it lasted a little bit longer than that. It took readings at the landing location with four instruments in its payload, and then it used its swing arm to hop to another location to gather another set of data. Once on the surface, Mascot got to work. The little hopping robot has four instruments on board, a camera, a spectrometer, a magnetometer, and a radiometer. Each of the four worked properly and transmitted the data back to Hayabusa 2. From there, the data will be sent back to Earth. Another optional robot is still on board Hayabusa 2, ready to be deployed. Let me drop. Next year, Hayabusa 2 itself will venture down onto the surface of the asteroid Ryugu. This is the culmination of the Hayabusa 2 mission, which at its heart is a sample return mission. The spacecraft will take three separate samples that should be delivered to Earth in 2020. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. Okay. Again, if you take a look at my link webpage, roy.ac2gs.com, you will be able to treat yourself to a little experiment on improving retention of written material. researchers and academics from different disciplines came together to design a new font, which they call, and I kid you not, Sans Forgetica. The font is believed to be the first typeface designed to help people retain more information and remember more of the typed study notes. I've rendered the Gettysburg Address in this font and posted it to my website. Personally, reading it hurts my eyes, but if you want to prove experts right or wrong, give it a read and see if you've retained any more of it than you knew before. I checked my calendar repeatedly to make sure it wasn't April 1st, but this is actual news. Let me see any questions or comments.
Question from Kilo Golf to Charlie.
Yes, Milan.
Hi, Roy. Is the font optimized for print or for screen usage? Because maybe they optimized it to work better for print, and maybe that's why it's giving you such a headache on the screen, if for some reason it's not well optimized for screen display.
I don't know for sure, but I made sure to blow up the font to a large size to be a little bit more tolerable on a computer screen. I'm not quite sure. I think they have in their strange little minds that if it's difficult to read, it's going to improve your memory having once figured out what it is you're trying to read. That's what I'm trying to glean from this study of guys with a lot of initials at the end of their name.
Okay, thanks, Roy. Back to you. Okay, we'll go to Charlie Clear.
Roy, I found the sentence that I think has a slight error in the original letter you sent back to Joe. We can go into that now or a little later. It's your choice.
Okay, we can go into it now.
Yeah, your reply to him had three paragraphs labeled number one, number two, number three. The second sentence of paragraph number one, where you give a website, and right after the website you said, which basically states that all other things being equal, point-to-point range decreases with the square of the frequency used. I think that should be linear. How do you, Roy?
Okay, but it sort of depends whether you're talking about decibels or not. And I'll give you, if you use decibels, which is a logarithmic term, then it seems linear. But I think you're using a logarithmic term, so I tend to think it's logarithmic.
Okay, let me be more direct. If I double the frequency, we're not talking about dBs now, I double the frequency, does the range change by 2 to 1 or 4 to 1? I say it changes by 2 to 1. That makes it linear. Over to you, Roy.
Okay, I bow to your knowledge. You've been doing this a heck of a lot longer than me. I will go back to my reference material and reread it and try and figure out what I got wrong or what's going on. But I don't know. I kind of gleaned that from my reading, but I will reread.
Okay, then I'll give the whole picture without using decibels. If I double the frequency, the free space loss does change by 4 to 1. So far, are you with me on that one?
Yes.
If I half the range, the free space loss changes by 4 to 1. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay. Doubling the frequency makes 4 to 1 increase in loss. Halving the range makes a 4 to 1 decrease in loss. Therefore, doubling the frequency only changes the range by half, 2 to 1. That makes it linear. Over to you, Roy.
Okay, so unfortunately what I probably did was I inferred the free space path loss to be the same as the range, which it isn't, because we live in a three-dimensional world and you have to factor that into the situation. So yes, okay, I agree with you. It's not by the square, it's directly proportional to the range. It's not directly proportional to the actual free space path loss, which is still the square.
Yes, I think you've got it. So if I double the frequency, I get four times more loss. If I half the range, I recover the 4-to-1 loss, and it comes back to the same number. So range versus frequency is linear. Loss versus frequency is square law. Loss versus range is square law. But one of the square laws is going up and the other one's going down, so it becomes linear in range versus frequency. I know, it's a little bit crazy. Go on to your next subject if you like. Over to you, K2IW.
No, I appreciate it, Dick. I mean, that's one of the reasons for being here. I like to learn as well. So I was a little bit loose with my terminology. I should have just stuck with free space path loss and not mentioned range, because I just inferred it out of nothingness. I shouldn't like that. But let me move on to an actual puzzler, because I think people like puzzlers. I don't know if they like them at 11:43, but I have a small puzzle tonight. It was suggested by an email that was sent to me. The gentleman was fascinated by a beautiful wide-angle photograph of the Mars rover Curiosity. Now, I posted that as well on my website. But what confused him apparently was what was actually taking these beautiful photographs. They're labeled by NASA as selfies, but where the heck is the selfie stick in the photograph? So, any ideas who or what is taking these photos? Are we paying foreign Martian citizens to fill our tax dollar subsidized photographer job? Any thoughts to explain this out there? I know Paul knows it. I'm pretty sure that Dick knows it. So anyone have any guesses of how these rovers are taking selfies of themselves without a selfie stick?
This one I don't really know, Roy. I'm going to make a guess that it was done with a selfie stick, so to speak, and then by some means they blocked out the selfie stick. That's a pure guess. Over to you, Roy.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul, I'm sure you know it. Dick got very, 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 very close to it, but I'm sure, Paul, that you know exactly what it is.
I was going to say, that selfie stick's a big stick. It's the end of the robotic arm that they have, and they have cameras at on the robotic arm, and this camera is able to move to different locations, above to the side, and so on, and then they splice all these pictures together, and that's why the pictures look the way they do. It looks like somebody with, it looks like it's all out of shape there. Some degree, not like a perfect picture. Back to you, Roy.
Yep, you got it. The answer is that unfortunately, a lot of times NASA plays games with the photographs, and that drives paranoid people crazy that they're being lied to, and God knows what else. But what this is a case of stitching together multiple views of an extended camera on an arm. And it's simulating a wide-angle lens that doesn't exist. The lens isn't as wide-angle as it seems, and the view isn't from as far away as it seems. But when they stitch it together and kind of undistorted, get this lovely wide-angle image where there's no anything that's possibly coming out of the rover itself to take pictures. So that's the simple answer to the whole thing. It's stitched together, it's a composite photograph, it's not an actual still life, if you will.
With that long arm, with one single shot as a selfie, the arm would be in the picture. But if you take a selfie with the camera at the end of the arm, and the camera is on a U-shape, it's on a fold-back, if you know what I mean. If you operate first with the arm tilted to the right and then the arm tilted to the left, combine those two pictures correctly with the right kind of blocking, I think you can block out the arm. You replace the missing background that was being shielded by the arm by the other picture. Therefore, you can make the arm disappear with putting the pictures right back together. That's a guess on my part. Is that possibly what they're doing, Paul? And then pass it back to Roy, WS2N, K2RIW.
Comments?
Yes, ma'am.
There's, of course, one of the two pictures, but, you know, yeah. And the wheels, everything looks like it's a little out of whack. I heard a comment in there, so back to you, Roy.
I think Malen had a comment.
Yes, I just wanted to mention what Dick was saying is correct, and actually that software is very fun to use. Some of it can be pretty complicated depending what type of projection you're trying to use and how much you're trying to really modify what's going on. But there are some free software packages, and some of them are pretty easy to do, and some of them try to intelligently figure out what you're trying to do. I remember Microsoft worked at one time, actually, I personally had used it because I had some big printed maps, and I wanted to have them on my GPS, but I didn't have a huge scanner to scan them. So I just took pictures of them, and obviously the pictures were, you know, from different angles, so they were skewed differently. And I use exactly that type of software to combine all these images that were partial images of a larger thing, and all of them were skewed and taken from different off angles. So, you know, obviously the perspective would be completely off in each of them, but the software is...
Seems to have cut out, Milan.
Okay, sorry, I think I timed out here. So the software is able to stitch everything together, and it's very fun to use, and basically figures out which pieces go with which pieces algorithmically. That's all I wanted to comment on. Back to Ned from Kilo Golf to Charlie.
Sounds like Photoshop.
Photoshop, I don't think, has a stitching... a sophisticated stitching algorithm. It probably has a relatively simple one. Microsoft has a program that does it. Apple, the iPhone camera does panorama stitching. And a lot of software can do it to a degree. My understanding with NASA is they're based on something like 17 plus different photographs stitched together. And if you click the link on my page, it takes you to a... that also has a wonderful computer graphic demonstration of how they stitch these things together. Very informative.
Hey, Baba Zulu, comment?
Yes, Rich.
Maybe it's a question. Are you saying that NASA stitches together photographs and, as the term is, alters the photograph by taking things out of it artificially? When I say artificially, like, you know, you do Photoshop out, as the saying goes, different elements of the picture?
They do, and they've been playing with photography since the very beginning. They use what's called pseudo colors to heighten the differences of things. So sometimes their photographs look way more colorful on a camera, on a computer screen, than they ever do in a spaceship. So unfortunately, there are flat Earth people out there who think that NASA has pretty much photoshopped everything and nothing really exists. But unfortunately, they feel that it's more educational and informative to modify the image, even though some people don't really like when you modify images. We're getting more and more used to it. Almost every image we see tends to be photoshopped in some way.
I could understand, you know, colorizing something to make it more understandable, but, you know, a picture of the rover, there, you know, were you just saying that they photoshop out the selfie arm and the camera or whatever?
Well, yeah, but that's not their primary goal, at least my understanding. The problem is that they don't have a very long arm or a wide-angle lens. So what they do is they take one pose and they move it to another pose, and they take a series of you know, 15 to 20 snapshots. Then when they have to stitch it all together, they scratch their head and say, well, we could have 20 pictures with the selfie stick and the camera in the way, or we can actually just get rid of it because we don't really need to see the selfie stick and the camera. So that's what they've always done. If you ever see any beautiful pictures of either of the rovers, you tend not to see the selfie stick unless someone's kind of diagramming the structure itself. So that's an aesthetic choice of NASA.
As the way, as you just explained it, it's not so objectionable. But it's, I don't know, I was thinking about, you know, one photograph taken by the rover, one photograph altering that, just one photograph. But the way you just explained it is fine with me. with you too, Bravo Zulu.
We live in a brave new world, unfortunately. For about an hour and a half, a lot of people wanted a special symbol placed on the side of any photograph that was massaged, let us say. That kind of came and it kind of went. Again, as far as I'm aware, almost everything gets tweaked, gets adjusted, gets moved, gets manipulated. And it's only going to get more confusing in the future. They're going to be able to simulate actors moving in scenes that they were never in, saying things that they never did, so you won't even be able to believe your eyes anymore. It's a brave new world.
I spent 2 years retouching and revitalizing those John Lennon pictures that I took, as you know, Roy. 2 years doing it. To clean them up and to make them look like they were taken yesterday. So I know all about that stuff. Guess it's getting close to the witching hour, so W2BZ. Thanks, Roy, and everybody else.
Welcome, Rich, and I'm glad people were amused with the puzzler, and that was from an email. So please, you guys, if you have any particular question or any great ideas for puzzlers, please send it here, mailbag@ac2gs.com. So it's coming up to the witching hour, as Rich mentioned, so you want to wrap things up for tonight?
You got 5 minutes where you could squeeze in another puzzle poll, Roy.
Well, I don't have a puzzle, but I have a relatively short article, and I guess I'll just talk very quickly. How's that?
Go for it.
Okay. Somewhat in the vein of our previous news, possible Russian microwave or ultrasound weapons used on our diplomats in Cuba, comes new tiny chips being inserted, reportedly, into U.S. computer equipment manufactured in China. It was alleged to be used as part of a vast effort by Peking to steal U.S. technology secrets. Bloomberg News reports that the chips, which are the size of a grain of rice, were used on equipment made for Amazon, which first alerted U.S. authorities and Apple, and possibly for other companies and government agencies. Bloomberg said a 3-year secret investigation, which remains open, enabled spies to create a stealth doorway into computer equipment, a hardware-based entry that was more effective and harder to detect than the software hack. Citing unnamed U.S. officials, Bloomberg said a unit of the People's Liberation Army were involved in the operation of the chips on equipment manufactured in China for U.S.-based Super Microcomputer Incorporated. Let me drop for a sec. Supermicro, according to Bloomberg, also manufactured equipment for the Department of Defense Data System, CIA's drone operations, and onboard networks of Navy warships. The report said Amazon discovered the problem when it acquired software firm Elemental and began a security review of equipment made for Elemental by California-based Supermicro. According to Bloomberg, the spy chips were designed for motherboards, the nerve center for computer equipment, used in data centers operated by Apple and Amazon Web Services, and others. Apple said in a statement, it has never found malicious chips, hardware manipulation, or vulnerabilities purposely planted in any server. Amazon said in a statement that at no time, past or present, have we ever found our issues relating to modified hardware or malicious chips in Supermicro motherboards or in any Elemental or Amazon system. Let me drop for a sec. Supermicro denied any knowledge of the espionage or the investigation that was reported. So, is this real or just some overactive paranoid nightmare? All I know is that just before I turn my Lenovo off at night, I wish everyone listening in from the Middle Kingdom a pleasant dream in Cantonese, just to be polite, just in case they're listening. Let me drop for any comments or questions about whether the Chinese now are spying on all of us.
GXM.
Yes, WB2GXM.
I boiled all my rice about 2 hours ago. I have no issues. WB2GXM out.
Very good for you. Supposedly, these little rice chips are so you can even insert them within one of the internal layers of the printed circuit board. So you could take a printed circuit board and probably throw it into a boiling pot and boil it, and that chip would still work. So go figure. Okay, so that was my paranoid story for the week. I think I might have a regular paranoid story because there seems to unfortunately be more and more of them every time I go looking for them. Okay, dokie, I'm basically done. It's only, you know, it's 11:59, so there's one more minute to go, so I figure that we probably should wrap up, and I have a lot of things to talk about next week, I'll tell you. But once again, please send me emails, send me questions, send me answers, send me complaints, send me praise, send me anything you damn well want. Mailbag at ac2gs.com.
Thank you, Roy. Well done. Thank you, Paul. Well done. And Paul, you made a special effort to make sure a launch got to occurred tonight, just so we had something to watch to really see the kind of launches you've been talking about, and it occurred during the TechNet itself. WS2N, K2RW. Thank you, Roy.
Okay. I tried to do this a couple of months ago. It was a late night launch, but they delayed the launch to like 2:30 in the morning, so we were out.
Okay, bye-bye you guys. Bye-bye you all. See you next week. K2RW, TechNet Limelight, we're clear.
Paul, hang in there for a second. I got a question for you.
Okay, you're about to be cut off. Give it a try.
I'll try.
WS1. Paul, what's the best browser to watch that launch on? IE won't do it at all. And I tried Google Chrome, and it was very, very spotty. I managed to watch it on my phone, no problem. Do they have a browser they recommend?
I use Google Chrome. I have no problem. I also have a tablet. But Google Chrome, in fact, I have a Chromebook. That's what I use. So I've tried it on Microsoft equipment as well. I don't know. I don't know why it was spotty. I mean, it was. I didn't lose one little second of anything. No pixelating. No nothing. Back to you.
Yeah. Thanks. Spotty was the wrong word. I should have said it was actually in slow motion. What it was. It was very slow. The guy talking and stuff, and it just was. It was very slow. Whereas on the phone, it was. It was all fine. Okay, I'll have to check. I don't use Chrome a lot. Maybe there's something in there I have to adjust. Just thought I'd check with you while you're in here. Thanks a lot. KC1SAM here.
Yeah, I've got a Linux system, and I watched it on Mozilla Firefox. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah. Well, he's close. He's got it on the phone, but, you know, he's just got to straighten the other thing out. He'll get it. And, if it's a NASA launch, if they're launching a Dragon cargo vehicle, or, you know, next year people, then you can see it on both SpaceX website and the NASA TV website as well. Anything NASA, they will put it on. The only problem is NASA sometimes skips the landing, so I like to watch both when they do that. Although, not all the time. When in last February, when they had the both boosters came back, NASA did put that on. So, not all the time, but most of the time, they'll cut it out.
Wait, did I drop out tonight much?
Oh, yeah.
I would say not as much.
And I was hearing bursts of noise on my talk, too. and the rate at which I was getting the bursts of noise and the rate at which you get a dropout is about the same. They might be related.
That's interesting. We should tell Eric about these things.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the WQVL repeater. Welcome. 2, the W2VL repeater.
J6, listening in. Good morning.
Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
Do I have K60?
20, go to 5-2. I'll meet you. 5-2.